So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast, coming to you from the Guardian Edinburgh International Television Festival. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, all the gossip, all the intrigue from the biggest event in the British television calendar. From Armando Iannucci's barnstorming keynote to the many new commissions announced during the festival, plus the dozens of TV execs who take time out from the conference centre to scour the fringe for the next big comedy hit. We speak to BBC commissioning editor Ed Sleeman about what he's looking for. All of that coming up on this week's Media Podcast. Well, has it been a year already? We have descended upon Edinburgh once more for what is essentially the TV industry's Glastonbury. Although you could argue that now the BBC sends so many staff to Glastonbury that Glastonbury is actually the TV industry's Glastonbury. Nonetheless, the TV festival is a big deal, and joining me amongst the delegates as they thrust and shuffle their way from sessions to talks to parties are Boyd Hilton and Faraz Osman, two of our favourites. Boyd, you are Heat Magazine's TV editor. That is reason enough for you to get a free pass to anything.
Correct.
But you've been chairing some sessions here at the
TV. I have, yeah. Every year I come to this thing. I think it might be my 14th year. And I do host a number of sessions. And this year I've hosted Multi-Channel this morning, which was with basically controls from MTV, Comedy Central, Nat Geo, and A&E Networks.
Do they have something of an inferiority complex like they might have done in the past?
They pretend they don't.
Yeah.
But actually, they do. I think they know what their jobs are really important. You know, I mean, like, funnily enough, there's something like Nat Geo, which I don't pay much attention to personally, but he's commissioning, like, things that cost billions of dollars with America and with, like, Ron Howard. And it's huge, big stuff, actually. So I learned a lot myself. So that was genuinely interesting. And then I did a thing for the network, for the youth thing. With my friend Ben Winston, who's James Corden's producer of his chat show in America. That was really interesting. He talked us through his whole career, and that was great. And then tomorrow I'm doing the head of Sky One, Adam McDonald, tomorrow morning, controller session. So, yeah.
They make you work for
they
your...
They make me work. Yeah, I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
I mean, make no bones about it. I'm exhausted. But it's fun as well. I genuinely like it.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of covered this last year, but as much as anything, it's about the social... elements.
Yeah, but I'm a total geek. I love the sessions, you know. Yeah. I love going from session to session. Well, not all of them, but the ones I pick out carefully. But, you know, I literally go through the programme, pick out ones I want to go to that don't clash with mine.
Maybe when you come for your 25th year, they'll take The Guardian away from the title and just make it the Boyd Hilton Festival.
Yeah, amazing. That'd be good.
It's only a matter of time.
That's the future.
talking of the future, Faraz Osman, managing director of TV Indie Lemonade Money. Are you up for business or pleasure this year?
I'm having a bit of a forced existential crisis, to be honest. Like, so we're doing a lot of stuff with a lot of brand partners. We're working with Vivo, we're working with Nando's, we're working with just done some stuff with Virgin Media. But I guess for me, kind of coming here, there's always a bit of a question about, okay, what does this look like? Is this merging? Is it not merging? Are they getting further away? So it's always good to get here and figure out exactly where the land lies with television. And like Boyd, I'm a massive telly geek, and you know, I think this industry is is fascinating, both politically and technically and editorially. So you get to see all of that, and it's a lot of fun.
And free beer.
I don't drink, so I'm here. There is like a whole level of experience I don't understand, where people come up to me kind of going, "Are you really drunk?" And I'm like, "No." And they're like, "What are you doing here?" Like, people keep saying to me, "What are you doing here?" And I'm like, "I'm at a TV festival. I'm not what." And then I kind of go, "Well, if I'm at a TV festival, I'm not watching TV because no one watches TV here. I've missed everything. I missed the Bake Off. Like, I don't know what's going on there. Someone's probably dropped a pie. No idea what's happening there. And I'm at a festival and I'm not drinking. So to actually, this is a bit of an issue for me. I have no idea why I'm here. I probably should get the train back now.
Oh God, that must be a very different experience. Pretending it and not drinking. I can't really compute that.
I'm not sleeping as well. But I think that's.
Oh no, I haven't slept. I haven't slept, but I have drank.
Okay, right, let's talk about the biggest story at the festival. And that, of course, is Armando Iannucci and his acclaimed McTaggart lecture. He got a standing ovation and everything. We at the Media Podcast had a front row seat, although actually we did retreat backwards one row just so we didn't look like nerdy fanboys. Here is a taster of what went down on Wednesday night.
If public service broadcasting, one of the best things we've ever done creatively as a country, if it was a car industry, our ministers would be out championing it overseas, trying to win contracts, boasting of the British jobs that would bring. If the BBC were a weapons system, half the cabinet would be on a plane to Saudi Arabia to tell them how brilliant it was. And yet it's quite the reverse. They talk of cutting down to size, of reining in imperialist ambitions, of hiving off, of limiting the scope. And they do it with all the manic glee of a doctor ever so reasonably urging his patient to consider the benefits of assisted suicide.
Unquestionably troop rallying stuff from Armando Iannucci. He obviously felt this needed to be said. Do you agree with him that it did need to be said, Boyd?
I agreed with every single word of it. I read it first, because the journalists get sent it to read. So I read it first and I thought, there's one bit I kind of disagree with, which is about the BBC Online. So, because I think, you know, I've always thought the BBC's a website. Like, why are they doing a website? I remember even when they started, I'm that old, I can remember, why are they even on the web? You know, why do they need to do that? And they're not a publisher, they should be doing programmes, you know. But he even convinced me on that, because he pointed out that, you know, it's the 60th most acclaimed website in the world, and, you know, it would be
the
weird.
Only British one in the
list. Only British one in the list. It would be weird for the rest of the world. And even that convinced me when he said it out loud. So I agree with everything he said. I think it was by far the best McTaggart I've ever seen. I've seen about 14 of them. Apparently Dennis Potter did one about 30 years ago. That was probably brilliant. Apart from that, there hasn't been one that came close to that one. I mean, last year's was so boring, I can't even remember what it was about.
Yeah, a lot of listeners won't even remember who it was.
No.
To recap, it was David Abrams, wasn't it, from Channel 4?
Oh my God, it was diabolical.
Yeah, it was kind of...
You remember how angry I was this time last year?
So this year... It was unremarkable, I think, is
fair to say. It just shows you, if you get someone who, he loves TV, like we do, I think, he knows his stuff, and he's funny. He's a brilliant writer, so he's brilliantly structured, full of jokes, full of righteous indignation, because he's right about the BBC. It was just fantastic. I couldn't be happier with it. And it was like, and it's completely set the tone for the whole festival, because it means that everyone's got something really interesting and fun and important to talk about and to react to, rather than the utter tedium that it was last year. And most years, the Kosaki is boring. Let's face it, most years it's boring.
When you get the lecture before they arrive, do you read it in his voice, or like the voice of one of his characters?
I was reading it in his very, very, in his great Scottish brogue. Yeah, I could hear him saying it. But you know what? Funny, I was thinking, should I bother going? Why are you, like, you know? But then I wanted to see him deliver it, because there was this great bit in the middle where he did this battle thing. You talk about that, kind of did a symbolic battle for the BBC. And that was so fun that I was really glad that I watched it as well.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think the big headline would be if it was rubbish. It's, you know, he's a comedy writer. He's at a TV festival. He makes TV comedies. He's probably, I would argue, one of our best writers we have in television right now. You know he's going to advocate this area. Everyone loves him. It was an amazing speech. It was by far my favourite that I've heard, certainly top to all the other ones that I've seen in the last few years. The only surprise would have been if it was terrible, which it certainly wasn't. It was going to be great, and it delivered on that.
Okay, but let's talk about some of the things that he said that I have qualms about, even if you're not going to express them. How about this?
Yeah.
He says the BBC should be trying to make as much money as possible by selling its material abroad.
Yeah.
And in principle, I get that, because it would raise the coffers and subsidise the licence fee. Isn't there a danger, Boyd, that by doing that, the focus of the commissioners would be on, can we get an international audience for this, rather than are we serving the license fee payers at home, which is ultimately what the BBC
is for?
No,
I think what he meant was that they're not milking what they currently produce, which happens to have a huge international appeal, to its fullest possible extent. So they've got these huge, big gems, you know, which do have an international appeal, and they're not actually earning as much money from them as they could, or they're not, you know, they're not. It's almost the system isn't allowing them to do it. So, I mean, he definitely wasn't saying, you know, they've got to look for international appeal, because, and that would be. I just don't think they would even begin to do that.
But of course, wasn't saying that, but it's cause and effect, isn't it? Like, if you end up with half of the BBC being funded by the sales of programmes that you make because they appeal to an international audience, you're going to stop making stuff perhaps that's so domestic.
Oh, yeah, but he wasn't saying that. He wasn't saying half of it. He wasn't saying it. He was just saying they should be allowed and they should be better and they should proudly go forth and make sure they make money out of their international hits. It was more. You know, the end product of what they're producing should be milked for more money. And I agree with that. I mean, all right, you could at a stretch say the cause and effect might be, but I just don't believe that's true. And I think if they did start doing that, I mean, it's almost impossible today anyway. You can't, you know, you can come up with great formats and ideas. If they end up having international appeal, brilliant. If they don't, then they don't.
Okay, qualm number two for us. Politicians basically shouldn't interfere with the creative industries, and if they do, I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, obviously, but the implication was, if they do, they should always seek the consultation of creatives as well as executives. Fine, but actually, there's nothing wrong, is there, with politicians examining the BBC, which receives a big slice of public money?
No, of course, there's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, that's what needs to be done, because it is public money. And I think that there's this ongoing debate, both in households when they pay the licence fee and when they see the content on their screens, and also when we're looking at government policy as well. I think for me, the reason that we keep coming back to this, and the reason that these sort of things are so fascinating, is because television, like politics, just isn't an exact science. There's no right or wrong answer. There's no sense of, you know, your question earlier about whether we should be making more money abroad. I mean, no, I don't, as a TV producer, kind of go, right, I need to think of the idea that's going to spend the most amount of money like around the world. You don't do that. You kind of go, this is a good idea. This may attract that commissioner. I don't think commissioners look at ideas and go, oh, is this going to be a worldwide hit? They go, is this going to be a good idea for what I'm looking for right now? That then generates a whole other market where they're like, well, does this work internationally? But there's no, I don't think there's one route where you're like, right, we need to figure this out or we need to figure that out. I think people just come up with ideas and people celebrate them. Some of them work, some of them don't, and that's great. And I think what the frustration is across the industry when it comes to politics is that they then try and focus group it and they try and have a discussion and a round table and come up with an answer about the value of the BBC or the value of public service broadcasting, and they never really get to one. But for me, the key thing about this debate is I feel we need to start separating the licence fee debate with the BBC debate. They're too intertwined at the moment. And I think there's a genuine problem with how we collect the licence fee and then how that gets distributed back again. And I think we need to start thinking about how, you know, is it having a licence fee, is that the best way of doing it? And then forward from that, whether or not the content that the BBC is making is the right reflection for those licence fee payers. Having a debate is the right thing to do, and that's why we have charter renewal.
Just to address the politicians looking into the BBC thing, he wasn't saying the politicians shouldn't be examining the BBC in any way they see fit. What he was saying was they're talking to the wrong people. He was saying if they talk to creative people who are actually making this stuff, they would get a very different set of answers, and that's absolutely right. I mean, it's bizarre that he was saying the line of the panel, the Whittingdale group, is demented, you know. It's like, doesn't include, that was his point he was making, doesn't include any creative people. It should be including Stephen Moffat, you know, for example. And that's the point. It's not, they absolutely should be looking at the BBC, of course. The BBC has to be accountable to us, the public, and they are the conduit for that. But once they start only talking to the bigwigs and other executives and the people, you know, who that class, if you like, working in the industry, they're only getting one side of it.
And I think the frustration that people have is that when you put together a panel like that, you can almost figure out what the answer is before even start speaking. And that's where people get frustrated, is that if you're not going to invite creatives to it, you're not going to have a discussion about...
On the way from the MacTaggart lecture to the dinner, right, last night, I met one who shall be nameless executive who was offended, right, to be classed in this group of, like, TV bigwigs who aren't creative.
You don't know what they're talking about, yeah.
Right, yeah. So he was mildly, not a lot, but, and I said, well, look, you know, what he's saying is, and I think this is so true, there are people who are creative that go on to become bigwigs, of course. You know, they're not all people who've just been, you know, like, commissioning their whole lives. There are, believe it or not, there are some people who've actually made TV shows.
Well, including Iannucci himself, who had a role in commissioning, didn't he, at the BBC
for
a while.
But this is the point, and I think this is the underlying issue, is once you become an executive, it almost like you start speaking in a different way and thinking and communicating. The difference between sessions at this thing with people who are actually writing and making and directing and starring in TV shows and the ones who are in charge of them is so weird. They all start talking in this kind of like rather tedious political way about stuff, but the creatives don't, you know, they're just very honest about stuff, and that's the difference.
Someone else who was in the audience, and it emerged this morning at the post-McTaggart kind of deconstruction chat that Amanda Iannucci himself didn't even realise he was in the audience, was the Culture Secretary, John Whittingdale. In fact, he was sitting next to me. We were monitoring his reactions throughout the event. There was an absolutely priceless moment right at the end when Amanda Iannucci got a standing ovation. Albeit these things slightly have a Mexican wave formation, it took maybe 5 seconds for the audience to get to their feet.
Yeah.
It took John Whittingdale about 15 seconds, during which time he looked either side to his aides to decide whether this was a good idea or not.
That's classic, yeah.
And in fairness, he was essentially standing up to applaud the fact that he was an idiot or sitting down to look like he couldn't take a joke. So either way, it wasn't going to work for
him.
That's
brilliant.
So I did feel a little bit sorry for him.
Yeah,
but
don't feel sorry for him.
No, okay, fine. I don't really. And no. I'm playing a devil's advocate with the other stuff as well. I love Amanda Iannucci. He's brilliant. John Whittingdale did do his own session here earlier in the day, didn't he? Alistair Stewart was asking him about the BBC cuts. And he said the BBC should try to make the same efficiency savings as we're asking every public body to do. And he also talked about Channel 4. He said the ownership of Channel 4 is not currently under debate, which, of course, isn't the same thing as saying it's safe. Do you think he did enough to allay all the fears about that, or did he make things even more complicated?
I think with the Channel 4 story, there's always going to be an underlying tone about that. Do we need to have another public service broadcaster that's owned by the state? And I think that's going to be an ongoing argument for as long as Channel 4 is owned by the state. And I think that, again, it's a good thing that we continue to debate that. But there's never going to be a right or wrong answer to that, because they're never going to kind of state their claim to that until we actually get an answer about what's going on. So I think that story is exactly what you expect a politician to say, and that didn't surprise me in any way. I think that the thing about Whittingdale and his chat around the BBC is I'm not necessarily a fan of what the Tories are doing right now when it comes to media. In fact, I'm not a fan at all in any way, shape or form. But I think that what's interesting about what John Whittingdale is doing is that he is very much advocating a debate. And I think that we need to engage with that, and we need to make sure, which is actually the really good work that broadcasts have been doing, is that they've very strongly been trying to make sure that debate actually happens and people actually are talking about it and defending it and riling a bit more passion around what I think is our greatest public service.
Yeah, I mean, one final conspiracy theory on this from me. Is it possible that this whole debate around Channel 4 and the BBC, it's not a coincidence that it came about after the decision made behind closed doors again about the BBC's funding?
The whole thing.
But actually, the whole thing's designed so that people get upset about that bit, the new bit, and then don't talk about the deal that was done behind closed doors again and get upset about that, which we would be if this other discussion wasn't happening.
Partly. The whole thing, for me, the whole thing is a load of old absolute bullshit, because what it is John Whittingdale and Ed Vasey have to appeal to the probably half, maybe, of the Tories, of his MPs, I mean, who hate the BBC viscerally and philosophically because they think they're a bunch of lefty liberal twats, even though they're not, and that they think you should shut it down, pretty much. I'm serious, you know, he has to appeal. This is politics. It's the most mindless, obvious, basic politics. The Tory culture minister has to appease the idiots in his party who hate the BBC, and the Mail, and the Telegraph, and the Times, and all those vested interests that also philosophically against the BBC. That's what it's about, nothing more. So I completely reject the notion. The BBC, let's face it, pretty much 90%, that's completely plucked out of the air, of what they do in terms of content is
it's better research than that.
Better
statistic.
Than everyone else. Yeah, it's excellent and is of appeal to a vast number of people, and it's of a quality that's as high as it's ever been, higher than it's ever been, right? And you know, bottom line is, as Amanda Iannucci basically was saying, in the end, after this whole process, it'll end up being pretty much the same as it is now. Thank God.
Right. This is the media podcast, not the politics podcast. But I should just mention that as we sit here now, discussing and debating, another politician, a rather significant one around here, is in the building. The Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, is currently delivering the alternative MacTaggart. But I can tell you what she's going to say.
Oh, yeah. What's she saying?
Because I got the embargoed text of that one emailed through as well. She's going to talk about the media industry being over-reliant on social media to get their source of easy stories. She says really? That risks sacrificing some of the best traditions of news gathering and investigative journalism in Scotland and the UK. That's not the main thrust of her speech, which, as you might imagine, goes on about BBC Scotland and right. all kinds of stuff that might right. not be of interest to the public at large. But that jumped out at me. Faraz, do you think she's right to talk about lazy journalism and a reliance and over-reliance on social media?
Well, I think that there was a really good book, you may remember it, called Flat Earth News, that spoke yeah. a lot about PR and how PR has changed the game when it comes to news gathering in this country. And I think that there is a legitimate argument to say that the speed in which we require breaking news, you know, coming to our phones and, you know, hitting our screens as quickly as possible has meant that, you know, mistakes have been made along the way and things have been over-reported when actually they're not that much of a story. That's going to happen. I think what social media allows is, you know, what particularly Twitter and how that's kind of, you know, explode, and Facebook now in the way that they've redesigned their newsfeed, is that they've exploded this notion of how you can both control the messaging and how it gets out there and what you want to do, but also it can get out of control as well, and you can't actually keep a hold of it, and that's made things more exciting when it comes to news. There is also, unfortunately, a situation where the biggest celebrities are now kind of overtaking the news agenda, because whenever they tweet something or say something, that becomes headline news, which I always find bizarre about why you need the news to basically tell you what somebody has tweeted about, which you could always get from your Twitter feed, which always confuses me.
But the vast majority of real people aren't on Twitter, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, if she's making that point, I agree with that. My mum's not on Twitter, you know, and I think the Twitter is a very, unlike Facebook, which is a vast, huge, you know, billions of people are on Facebook, right? Pretty much every, my mum is on Facebook. It's all about my mum. But so,
she's my main news source.
But if you're interested, yeah, you're right. But what I'm saying is that actually, as far as Twitter's concerned, I think it's kind of a media thing. People who tweet, people who look at it and really engage with it are kind of the media class, I think. Like, it's particularly big among them. So it's almost like a self-fulfilling thing. So, you know, celebrities argue with each other on Twitter, the Daily Mail reports on it, so does he, and then they respond to that, and it's kind of a thing.
And
I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
That is cheap journalism. Whether it's lazy or not, whether it's what the public want to read or not, it is cheap to employ a young person.
If my mum isn't on Twitter, and she's not seeing that, you know, thingy from One Direction is arguing with what's-his-name from whatever, about something, she might want to know, and reporting on it is fine. If these are real people discussing something vaguely interesting or even trivial and stupid, not everyone's on Twitter. So I think it's different. I do think it's different. I think it's valid. If she's saying people are looking at Twitter and Facebook for real news stories and kind of basing what they do on that, you know, kind of actually kind of going on the news agenda, going, oh, what are people talking about on Twitter and Facebook? I'm not sure about that. But I do think there's a kind of media obsession with Twitter that is, I mean, I love it, but I'm saying in the real world, it doesn't mean anything. You know, for example, I get lists of the most trending programs on Twitter, you know, and they never correspond, very rarely correspond to what actual people watch.
But there is a fascinating thing, again, I know, like you said earlier, we're not on the Today programme and we are actually talking about the media podcast, but I do get fascinated about when a news story breaks and you kind of go to all the politicians and go, right, what are they saying? Well, I want to comment from them in 140 characters immediately. And I'm sure someone like Nicola Sturgeon has that, where something happens, not even in Scotland, but around the world, and it's like, is she going to make a statement? And obviously you jump to Twitter straight away and go, you know, what is it that she said? And you need that very...
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project... there's a spray paint pattern that's just right, because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1, only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
sync soundbite from that politician to tell you what's going on. Yeah. And that's kind of led to something really interesting where journalists can almost kind of go down the list of important people to see what they've said about a particular subject in a way that you never would have been able to do 5-10 years ago.
And needless to say, the most important people to follow on Twitter at any time is at The Media Podcast.
And at Faraz Osman.
And at Boyd Hilton,
Not at Ollie Mann, though. He's a waste of space. Or if you are Giles Brandreth, regularly to be confused with at Ollie Mers. But anyway.
Really?
It's a quirk of Giles's.
That's bizarre.
You forgive Giles Brandreth.
Is that deliberate, do you think?
I think it is, okay. He thinks it's funny. It's a bit funny, isn't it?
So you're now hosting The X Factor?
It's a bit irritating.
Okay.
We'll have more after this. So there's not just the TV festival that's happening here in Edinburgh. You may have noticed there are a few other things as well, including the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. But guess what? That also attracts people from the telly industry. They're everywhere like locusts. Ed Sleeman is a commissioning editor for BBC Entertainment, and I've just joined him in the Pleasance Courtyard, which is why there's, I think, a buzzy, cool vibe around us, Ed.
Yeah, I love the courtyard. It's the first place I come to when I get here.
But here you are, masquerading as an ordinary punter. You've got your Mac on. You look normal. But actually, you're here representing a massive broadcaster. What are you looking for, Ed? What's the secret sauce?
I'm genuinely not looking for anything specific. I always look for a mix of people who I've seen before, and I'm looking out to see if, what they're now doing or if they've got any better or worse. I'm looking for people who I've just not seen before. I'll pick 5 people who I've no idea of, and I just pick them slightly at random. I might have heard 1 or 2 little things about them, and nothing specific. I just go to as many shows as I can. I think I'm doing about 30 this week.
It seems to me sometimes those recommendations are from people who do spend 10 hours a day in a venue watching comedy, and so they go for something that's a bit unusual. And actually, I imagine the pressure on you to find an act that might be mainstream enough to go on the telly means you're not necessarily looking for those kinds of acts.
I quite often will go to see shows with other producers. I was, I'm a commissioner now, but I was a producer before. And I've always hated it when producers, after a show, you sat with them and you laughed all the way through and you come out and they go, really enjoyed it, but I just don't know what you do with them. And you go, and I always think, well, that's not the point. They didn't write this show so that we could come and decide what we could do with them on telly. They wrote an hour show, quite often sort of laying their heart on the line, with all some of the shows are incredibly honest. So to come out and then say, yeah, but what can we do with them? How can we rinse them on telly? I've never really liked, so I do genuinely just try to go to see the show as much as I possibly can, as if I'm a fan of the act, or I've been recommended it. And it sounds really disingenuous, but it's true. I try to be as sort of respectful as possible and just watch the hour for what the hour is, rather than constantly whirling, going, well, what panel show can I get them on, which I just don't think is a healthy way to watch comedy.
And yet, if you're an aspiring comic and you do want to be on the telly, because ultimately that's where the money is, even if you're actually talking about live touring revenues as a result of being on a panel show, it's understandable, isn't it? You're going to try and tailor your show to impress people like you. Is that a mistake because you end up doing stuff that feels tried and tested? Or can you think of comics, you don't have to name them if you don't want to, who clearly have come to the festival with their hour so that they can get on Mock the Week and it's worked for them?
I don't know what a comedian would do to make me go, oh, they're panel show material, other than, I suppose, doing, some relatively quick, one-liners or something. But having said that, James Acaster has been one of my favourite, if not my favourite, shows in the last 3 years. And his style is just brilliantly, goes on these flights of fancy. Last year he was saying that he was an undercover detective called Pat Springleaf, and the whole comedy thing was just a ruse for him to try and solve some cases. I mean, it's ridiculous, flights of fancy. There's no way you would go, oh, yeah, well, that's what I want on my panel show. Because what you want on a panel show is someone who you can edit snippets down. However, James is an incredible comedian, and I always think we're really lucky to have him on any shows we have him on. So I suppose if anyone came in with that direct purpose of, I'm going to get on a panel show, I don't know quite how they'd attack that.
And a criticism of the Edinburgh Fringe over the past 10 years or so, and this is kind of how we ended up with the Free Fringe as a part of the festival, which is where people can go and pay what they want, is that the big venues, the Pleasance, the Underbelly, the Gilded Balloon, the Assembly Rooms, were dominating proceedings, and to get into there you needed to spend 10 grand or whatever it is on your publicity, which means you kind of need to have a production company or an agent behind you. What role do those kind of industry contacts have in ultimately deciding whether or not a commissioning editor or a comedy producer might go and check an act out? Are you willing to go with word of mouth and check someone out on the free fringe? Or is it often the case that you're told to go and see stuff because money's been spent on this guy? This guy's the next big thing.
I'd be really lying if I didn't say it wasn't a combination of the two. I mean, I will get from, I suppose, June onwards, the emails start coming in with the acts who are going to be up there, and then throughout, you know, on the run up to August and throughout August, I would say this year I've had, you know, 5-10 emails a day from big agencies and smaller agents, you know, who send their acts. But it's completely understandable. It's their job to get people to the shows, and, you know, and some telly people, as you say. You know, if that's ultimately their aim, is they want to do more telly, which I don't think should be the be all and end all, but if that is the aim, then they've got to do that. But having said that, I mean, so I've just come from a show in the Free Fringe. That was one of the ones I said where I literally picked his name out of the book. I liked the sound of the show, and I just thought, it's on at 12, I don't have a show that day, I'll go and check it out.
And can you give us a trade secret exclusive about someone you've seen this year who you actually rate?
I don't think it's any secret that Joe Lycett is having a brilliant festival. I mean, I think he was 3 years ago, and I saw him in one of the porter cabins, and there was about 12 of us in there, and it was a brilliant, brilliant show. It was one of my favourite shows that year. Saw him the other night, first night I was here, and he'd sold out the Grand, and, you know, hundreds of people there, and it was a really great show, and he was just sort of effortless and confident, and in terms of whatever Reddy is, as I say, Joe, I think, is ready. I don't think that's a secret. I think, I would say, I'd be surprised if lots of channels aren't trying to do more things with him now.
Well, we're still at the TV festival with Boyd Hilton and Faraz Osman, and of course it is in fact the international TV festival. There is certainly a lot of Americans here. Quite an impressive lineup, actually, including John Landgraf from FX, Rich Ross from Discovery, and Michael Ellenberg from HBO. But I wonder if they're as open as their UK counterparts. What do you think about this, Boyd? And you've been to a lot of TV festivals, as you were saying. I went to see David Nevins, who's the president of Showtime.
Yes.
And it was very exciting because he showed us a trailer for season 5 of Homeland, and that
brilliant.
Was quite glitzy.
Yeah.
A little bit too much Saul and F. Murray Abraham for my liking. Not enough Carrie, but you know. That's...
Oh, I love Saul.
Yeah, well, we all love Saul, okay. But we wouldn't want an overemphasis on Saul.
All
He's
right.
a supporting role.
All right.
But, you know, in terms of what he actually said about how he commissions shows,
yeah.
In terms of how he answered the questions that were put to him,
yeah.
It seemed to me the Americans are less used to being frank and honest and open in these kind of sessions than their British counterparts. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think the problem is the Americans are so slick. I mean, it's a cliche, but it's true. You know, American executives of any industry, probably, let alone TV, are so well-trained and so... I mean, they can't get to where they are, can they? Without being just completely political animals who know what to say and how to say it. And, you know, you compare... I mean, I agree with you. You compare those guys, and they're all brilliant. I mean, they're quite creative as well. I think they, in some ways, you know... I do think if you're the head of FX or Showtime, it's easier to be risky than if you're head of ITV or even Sky. But you compare them to, say, Stuart Murphy, who's this, you know, maverick, say whatever comes into his head pretty much within reason in his panels, and you think, you almost wouldn't get that, I don't think, from an American top-level TV bigwig.
And, of course, the other sort of faction that's here, in addition to the British TV executives, I guess, is kind of YouTubers and people like that. Faraz, do they deserve their place at this table? You know, there's still... a feeling, I think, that they're slightly second-class citizens. You know, it's worthy of a discussion. Oh, can you make money out of building an app? But it's not quite the same as what the people at, you know, BBC Two and ITV are doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of what I was mentioning at the top of this chat. I wasn't being flippant about it. Like, genuinely, we're doing some stuff with lots of online partners. What's going on with BBC Three at the moment and what's going on with all four at the moment suggests that broadcasters want to get into this space and figure out what it looks like and how it works. And actually, you've got a lot of these guys that are doing this in a YouTube space, and they've some of them have got much bigger audiences, even on television, than some of the broadcasters have got. And it's only fair that they actually come here and discuss what they're doing and what their experiences are along the way.
But will we be seeing a keynote from Zoella in 10 years' time? Or are they always going to be separated?
No, you won't.
Well, you say that, but I think that it's a genuine possibility that next year we will see the alternative McTaggart come from Zoella, and I think that that would probably be quite an intelligent booking to figure out what that looks like. I think that there is that feeling as to, you know, is this sustainable? Is it a bubble? Is it going to burst? What is it going to look like? You know, once the TV guys come into this space, they'll take it over and they'll find formats that people will actually want to watch, and actually it's just because there's not content that's there that's of high quality, but people just want to keep binging on this sort of stuff. I think that we've yet to see, we've been talking about it for a long time, we have yet to see a broadcaster, I think, although Boyd might be aware of one, I can't think of one off the top of my head, of a broadcaster putting something online and it being a massive hit in the same way that their TV brands are. Yet Zoella is a name that you know and I know and a lot of the people around here know, and she is a brand that's been successful.
Okay, you can hear the brain crowd of TV executives advancing around us at the moment. I think Nicola Sturgeon has chucked out.
Getting ready for the awards.
Yeah, everyone's getting ready for the awards, which
I was
happening
chair
later.
Of the awards panel, let me just say.
Oh.
So the awards, if people don't know, are kind of half voted for by, I think, anyone involved in the general organisation of this festival, and half by a specially convened panel of experts chaired by me. And it was a fascinating process, yeah. And I think it was a tough year. BBC One won Channel of the Year.
Okay. Why?
Well, I think it was kind of between BBC One and Channel 4. I'm not even sure if I'm allowed to say that. You know, I think Channel 4 won last year. Not that that doesn't mean it couldn't win this year. I just think, you know, BBC One has massive, big bake-off. World Cup coverage was astonishing. It had The Missing, which was brilliant. It just had a lot of really good... It just, you know... It is still producing the best content around, basically. And ITV was dipping, you know, not so good in terms of its drama and its scripted stuff. Nothing massively decent factually either. Channel 4 was the main rival.
Of course, the politically interesting thing would have been to give it to BBC Three.
Yeah,
that would be a Daily Mail headline right there.
It would have been, but. Yeah.
But you resisted that, which is good.
It was quite close, though, wasn't it? I remember. There was a lot of debate about. I think there was only like one or two votes in it.
Were you one of the judges as well?
I was.
Bloody
yeah,
hell, we get a good guest, later, don't we? My God. We get everyone. All these people around us work for the TV channels. They don't know who's won, and I'm talking to people who know. So, are you listening, Steve Hewlett?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I couldn't actually make the panel itself, but I got sent the tapes of what was on the shortlist, and it seemed quite obvious that it was a very tight race between BBC One and Channel 4 and BBC Three as well. And I think that you look at the shows that are on there, and actually it was very difficult not to give it to BBC One, particularly when you actually look at the stats of how well that channel's done and how it's actually...
The share is up,
and that's a difficult thing to do. And I think that the problem with judging award ceremonies and doing this sort of thing is that sometimes it becomes a competition of who does the best sizzle reel and who's got the best editing team in house. And I think that there was a real sense that when you watch the tapes, it was a bit like, oh, this is obvious, like who's going to win. And then when you read the actual literature that complements it, and you see the actual stats of how well things have been doing, you kind of say to yourself, well, actually, there's a TV channel that's doing very, very well at the moment, and there are others that aren't quite keeping up to pace.
Well, two big shows, whether they win awards or not, are obviously Strictly Come Dancing and The X Factor, both shortly to return to our screens. Now, something that intrigued me was the slightly awkward and bizarre session where Kay Burley was interrogating the leaders of all of the channels.
Yeah.
Did throw up this nugget that Peter Fincham, director of ITV, said on stage, sort of put the gauntlet down to Danny Cohen, the BBC director of TV programmes, that ITV are going to publish the times that The X Factor will be on every Saturday, and then it's in the BBC's court not to schedule Strictly up against it.
It was brilliant. Oh, it was for the first half of that session was unbelievably disappointing because nothing interesting came up, and then suddenly it came alive. You know, you had the five most powerful people in British broadcasting, kind of, and then it was all boring, and then suddenly this Strictly versus X Factor thing happened. I thought it was a great coup by Fincham to do that, and I did think it placed Danny. I have to say, clearly I'm a massively pro BBC. I do find their deliberate competitiveness over things like this irritating because they don't need to do it. That's the bottom line. And I do think it's slightly weird how competitive the schedule is, and Danny himself is. I mean, you know, I'm sure he'd admit it. And all BBC controllers are. They want to beat ITV. They want to hit X Factor's ratings, which really. And it's kind of. That's not really. Is it really their job? I don't know.
I think
Fincham's point was, their research is, and mine is too, as a Heat TV editor, our readers want to watch both. And they want to watch them both live, and they want to watch one after the other. And if you don't do that, you will get a backlash. And Fincham's political way of dealing with it was clever, I thought.
But isn't it part of the fun? Isn't it like to know who's beating what and like, you know, no, those headlines are Strictly's beating X Factor and X Factor's beating Strictly. That's part of the fun.
It's part of the fun, particularly for the media and for papers and, you know, to run headlines. But in the end, it doesn't matter because even if they're one after the other, you can still see who gets bigger ratings. That story still runs. So they don't have to clash for that to be a story because people are still obsessed with which show is more popular than the other, no matter when they're on. So that's still a story. It's like the thing is, they love actually being able to claw at the X Factor because they know if they put Strictly on right up against it while it's on, they will dent their ratings, and that is annoying.
But if they were a commercial organisation, so there wasn't the issue about they shouldn't be taking revenue away from a commercial organisation.
Yeah, but they're not.
But if they were a commercial organisation, it wouldn't just be about stealing the audience away from X Factor. It would be about giving a lead-in to whatever the show is that's on after Strictly.
Yeah, so the thing of Strictly is the National Lottery. I mean, who gives a shit?
It needs all the help it can get.
Yeah, right.
It's never been better than when Noel presented
it's
the
not
first
bad,
episode,
honestly.
In my
and,
view.
And the other thing is, I thought they were a bit disingenuous. He was kind of talked about, you know, oh, with the sporting events on. He likes denting X Factor ratings. That's the bottom line. And he doesn't need to do it.
Okay, so win to Fincham on that one, in your view.
I think so.
Okay. One other session that I went to anyway was called The Future of News. The BBC's head of news, James Harding, appearing at that event, talking about the speculation around BBC News Channel and whether that might go online, like BBC Three. He said the service was durable. You can't help but quote these people like they're politicians, can you, when they use words like that? He said its future would depend upon their mobile strategy. He said, over the last few months, we've been looking at how we can make sure that we have the skills to stream, and in that, you have to think, where would the world of news channels fit in? Do you think we still need a 24-hour BBC News channel
for
us? Oh,
my God, there's a lot of hyperbole in that, isn't there?
Yeah.
So my phone will stream my news in the future. It's like, okay, cool. I mean, the reality is that people get their news from lots of different sources, and actually having a news channel is, well, some people wake up in the morning, they turn that on, some people are in offices and they have it on in the background. It's useful to have a news channel as a TV, that's a TV channel, and I can't see that going away anytime soon.
So, something John Riley from Sky News said at the same event is, we are entering the world of the big correspondent. And what he meant by that, which is quite interesting, was he sees a world where even his big names on Sky News, Ed Conway, for example, with an expertise in a particular area, might feel entitled to have a contract whereby, because they're so in demand, they could appear on the Today programme in the morning for the BBC, do a briefing on the ITV lunchtime news, and then a programme on Sky in the evening, because their online following are interested in them.
That's interesting.
Or Robert Peston, or whomever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you see that happening?
Well, I mean, I think actually this is one of the things, bizarrely, that came out of the leaders' debate was Kay Burley and her ridiculous way of interviewing people, where she tries to pretend people have said things or done things that they just clearly haven't, and it's actually quite irritating. But Kay is clearly being employed because she's a personality, whether she rubs people up the wrong way or not, and that's part of Sky News' strategy, that they employ personalities, and that's the reason you come to their news channel over the BBC or ITV News, rest in peace. It's like there is a sense already that having kind of big news anchors across the day is one of the reasons why you stay with those channels. And that is Sky's strategy, and I can see that continuing to elevate. What worries me, particularly when it's somebody like Kay Burley, is when those news anchors become bigger than the news stories themselves. And it felt to me, particularly during that leaders' debate, that Kay was trying to be a bigger story than actually what any of these guys were saying. And people turned up for those leaders and not for her.
Yeah, I mean, final point on that, just in terms of sessions at the Edinburgh TV Festival. And Boyd, you say you've been to a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking about this as a presenter watching it.
Yeah.
This isn't a point about Kay Burley necessarily. It's about a lot of presenters who choose to be kind of antagonistic and confrontational to get a response. Inevitably, I can't help the fact that I'm watching that thinking, well, how would I present this session? What would I do? And
I'm
not sure that being confrontational is always the best approach when you're trying to get a response out of people in the industry to people in the industry. Seems to me like very often the presenters are trying to just show, look, I'm prepared to bite the hands that feed.
Yeah. Oh, definitely, yeah. No, I'm not very confrontational, as I'm sure people would know when they see me, anyone who's seen me do a session. I think you can still ask tough questions and the questions that have to be asked, but in a normal way. I watch Kay Burley, she is a good example. I watched Kay Burley in that session and I thought, you're a bit weird. It's all a bit, you're just socially a bit odd, the way you're communicating. I mean, there was a technical hitch with the sound, which didn't help. They couldn't hear each other. But just the way she deals with people is just odd. The things she says to people, it's rather contrived, and
I don't know. I just find it odd. So whereas for me, it's all about having a natural conversation. I'm trying to have a natural conversation if I'm hosting a thing here with whoever I'm interviewing, whilst at the same time making sure I ask them what the audience want to know about. That's the key. If they're politicians, I want Jeremy Paxman to be horrible to them, because that's brilliant. But they're not politicians. They're doing a job and they're making TV programmes.
But on the reverse of that, I think what Alistair Stewart did with John Whittingdale, I think he did an excellent job.
He is a politician. He needs to be very harshly.
And I think that he did an excellent job, and I think that made that a much more interesting experience. And I think that if you're going to be confrontational, you have to have the stats and the knowledge to back it up, and that's kind of key to all of this. And you could tell when you're in that session that there is a person on stage that knows more about this than you do. They're educating you, they're getting the answers that are going to matter, and that's what good interviewing should be about. It can't just be about shouting at people and pointing your finger in the hope that it'll provoke a response that will be a fluff and and you'll get a soundbite out of it that will be a faux pas and that will become the headline. That's not good journalism to me.
Okay, I want to sort of wrap up because there's a Bloody Mary downstairs at the awards with my name on it.
Yeah, got
there's
the
a
awards,
Virgin Mojito for you, Faraz, I'm sure. You can tell us what everyone gets up to when they've had too
drink,
many.
To be clear.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But despite the fact that alcohol is waiting for me around the corner, there is still time to squeeze in the media quiz.
Of course.
It is the highlight of the show. This week, it is entitled Outside the Bubble. There is an industry outside these four walls. But do our delegates know what else has happened in the media news this week? Best of three, buzz in with your name. The winner gets an invite to every corporate party at next year's TV festival. The loser has to go to every corporate party at next year's TV festival. Here's story number one. The Sun today published its first website traffic figures for 2 years. But how many did they get? Buzz in with your name.
Boyd.
Boyd.
72 people.
Faraz, higher or lower?
Well, it's obviously higher. I'm going to go website traffic over what period?
Yeah, I think it's uniques over a month.
Uniques over a month. For The Sun, I'm going to say 1.2 million.
800,000 just
under. It's pretty poor, isn't it?
Making it the least visited UK national newspaper website.
Wow, that's amazing.
Astonishing for the most popular paper.
That's a disaster. Their whole paywall thing was a complete disaster. What were they thinking?
When it launched, am I making this up? When it launched, didn't they actually launch it as The Current Bun? Wasn't it thecurrentbun.com?
Oh, probably, yeah.
I remember that and kind of getting very confused.
It was like when GMTV had GM.TV, wasn't it? It was an innocent age.
Bottom line, they've had to rethink that strategy.
They have.
Yeah.
And actually, in fairness, since it's only been a month of them kind of putting their biggest stories, Lord Sewell and the cocaine hookers and all that, up online, beyond the paywall. Actually, I mean, I'd be thrilled with 800,000 figures for a month, but... I'm not Rupert Murdoch, as you say. I think there's going to be
some discussions
at high levels about that. Daily Mail gets 14.3 million unique
Bloody
browsers
hell.
Per
wow.
day, by the way, in case you were wondering for a comparison. Right, story number two, control. That, in a word, is what politicians have so often craved to have when it comes to the BBC. But who wrote that this week? Buzz in with your name if you know the answer.
Come on, what was the publication that they wrote it in?
It was in The Guardian. The titular sponsors of today's event. You're both showing that you don't read The Guardian.
I was having that time, of course I do.
And it's free here as well. They're handing it out around here.
As free as The Sun's biggest stories, but you don't know. I'm going to have to put you out your misery if there's no answer. The answer was Nick Robinson.
BBC
correspondent Nick Robinson.
Right.
From his riposte in The Guardian to Alex Salmond's accusations of bias at the corporation.
Oh, yeah.
Well worth a read when you get home. And also, of course, Nicola Sturgeon at her alternative McTaggart talking about some of that stuff as well. Right, this is what we traditionally call the tiebreaker, although Boyd is probably going to run away with this, despite not knowing the answer. Which organisation was cruelly dumped by the BBC this week after a 90-plus year relationship?
Boyd, yes. The weather people. Meteorological...
No, too late. For us, yes.
The Met Office.
Oh, weather
people. Have some respect.
Oh, come on.
Going for a hard
you know what
right
I meant.
Now.
You have snatched victory from the jaws of defeat.
Oh, I thought it was a moral victory for me.
Do we know who it's going to yet, though?
No, it's been put out to tender. Scandinavian companies are bidding.
I want to say...
I don't know why I said that with disdain.
I think it'd be really interesting if there's lots of app developers to get into this space. So things that... Because weather apps have had a massive explosion recently, and things like Dark Sky is a huge, and it'll be interesting to see if there's a relationship between a weather app and the BBC weather.
I think what'll be interesting to see is how many of the Met Office presenters go off to present for whoever gets the contract now.
Yeah definitely.
I mean, because they're the faces, aren't they?
Totally.
You're not taking Schaffernacker away.
Schaffernacker's good. He'll be back. He'll be somewhere. Yeah,
well, on that reassuring thought, Boyd Hilton, thank you for
thank
joining
you.
us. Faraz Osman, congratulations on winning the quiz.
Thank you very much. Can I say, my favourite thing by far that I've seen at the festival is Boyd's trainers. Have you seen these?
Yeah.
I'm so jealous of these. They are actually amazing. And anybody that's here at the festival,
they look like a pair of normal night trainers.
They have to catch the light. They're iridescent in the light.
They're like chameleons. They're incredible.
Yeah, Producer Matt has taken a picture. Yeah. For those of you that have clung on to these final moments of the podcast, you can
see that at twitter.com/mediapodcast. I'm going to cherish that.
Today's show is dedicated to Colin Dowling, a long-suffering TC working for a Scandinavian broadcasting company that enjoys news and discussion from the wider media world. If you would like to support the show, like Colin, and get your name read out in my sexy voice and get my eternal gratitude as well, then please go to themediapodcast.com/dedicate. I've been Ollie Mann. The producer is Matt Hill. The Media Podcast is a PPM production. Until next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Bye-bye.